Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. And it's my pleasure to introduce our moderator here tonight, who came to me about 6 months ago or so with this idea for a panel discussion about something that's very relevant to his own studies. And so Anthony Alfitti is going to be our moderator tonight, and he told me to go on the panel, and he'll introduce our other panelists.
Thank you, George. I am Anthony Alfitti, club member since 2005, and I'd like to introduce the topic of morality of warfare. Interesting topic, covers everything from philosophy, ancient literature, and the impacts on modern technology and foreign policy. It's important to me because as a currently serving lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army Reserve, I'm deploying to Afghanistan quite soon. And so this is something that hopefully we can draw moral lessons from today in our contemporary lives and something that can impact what's going on downrange in an active theater of operations. My colleagues downrange know that we're doing this tonight, and I intend to share the podcast link with them when it's published. This is something that can potentially clarify policy objectives, improve our decision-making in combat, and perhaps even save innocent human lives. So I ask for your full participation tonight. Let's introduce our distinguished panel. First, Dr. Peter Dale Scott, the gentleman farthest from me. Dr. Scott is a former Canadian diplomat and professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. He has published and lectured extensively over the past several decades covering an alternative critique of U.S. foreign policy. And my favorite work that he has done is called Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, an early exploration of what we now know as deep state theory. And thank you, sir, for autographing my personal copy tonight. I've had that in my library 20 years waiting for your signature. And we also have Mr. George Hammond tonight, who is a longtime chair of the Humanities Forum here at the Commonwealth Club, has spoken extensively on philosophical topics. So let's have a round of applause for our panel, and welcome. Gentlemen, let's get started with some theology. Just war theorists like St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas wrote about morality and warfare using the language of their time, such as invoking religious appeals. How would modern wisdom adapt these philosophical traditions for more secular times today?
Well, I think it's very important if we want to understand the problem of war and what to deal with it, to look at it in a historical perspective, and that involves also looking at the history of just war theory in a historical perspective. You heard two names, St. Augustine and St. Thomas, and they are, in fact, the giants, I think, in this theory. Particularly St. Augustine, at the very beginning, he lived in the century when the empire had become Christian, and before the two had been opposed to each other, and now they were interfacing, and in many ways he was trying to develop a notion of Christianity that could be responsible for the world and help to steer the world. So he gave the idea that wars that are unjust should not be fought, which from the point of view of a secular state was immense progress because the Romans just fought for the sake of Rome. I don't know of any case where a Roman war was interrupted or even criticized. But from the Christian perspective, something was lost because until that century, it was assumed that if you were a Christian, you wouldn't fight. And St. Martin is the famous example of a saint who was a soldier originally. When he converted, then that was the end of his being a soldier, open and shut. And another saint whom I quote in a poem said, Christianum non possum militari. I'm a Christian, therefore obviously I can't make war. And so I think something was lost as well as gained by developing the notion of a just war. And if I could jump, and I have to do this very quickly, in the case of St. Thomas, who is much more at ease and has a much more developed system for the world, he's also more critical, I think, of secular authority than St. Augustine, who really didn't identify with it at all. And he gave us some very good criteria that a war had to be for a good cause, and above all, it had to be for the sake of peace. And that, I think, has become incorporated in most moral and legal theory since that time. So, yes, this is progress, but I think also something, again, was lost, because the more you develop a notion of a good just war theory, it becomes a kind of specialty. You have to understand that when he wrote, the world was at war all the time. You didn't declare war. You were just always at war. Usually in the winter, you came home and let the snows cover the fields, and then in the spring, you sowed your crops, and then it was time to go out and make war. I think that's why the month March is named after the god Mars. And so this was to, in a constant state of warfare, this was an idea of setting criteria to limit it. It's not the only one. I know some of you may have heard of the Truga Dei, the truce of God, which the church introduced as a notion. Well, you know, you're making war all the time. Why not take one day off a week and not make war? And from that modest beginning, we have come to the idea that the normal state is not a state of war, is a state of peace. But if you say that there are just wars, then you set up courses and say, how are we going to fight a just war? And that becomes, I think, dangerous because from, I just give my own perspective, there's no such thing as a good war. When we think of World War II, some people think it was a good war. No, I mean, I think it had to be fought. I'm not a pacifist. I accept that wars have to be fought, but you must never think that we're in the area where we're fighting a just or a good war. It's always terrible. It is always damaging to the notion of peace. We're going to come to the next question where we're talking about law, but essentially the notion of law has, I think, essentially taken the place of just war theory, and just war theory now should be within a legal context because by themselves, I cannot think of any. I can think of wars I might fight, though I'm very lucky that being of my own generation, I was too young for World War II. I never had to fight a war. There is no such thing as a good or just war.
Yeah, I think I'm going to pull in an idea that Professor Ian Morris from Stanford, I've had him speak here a few times, about violence in human society. Because if we're trying to understand how people have thought about this, as Peter was saying, over history, it's important to see how much violence there was in their lives as opposed to today. And the historians that look into this think that there was, say, I think it was a 10 out of 100 chance that you would die a violent death for most of history, and that it went up and down, so on and so forth, but that now it's way under 1 out of 100. It's much less than 10% of what it was at its height. I think it's even much more than that. And so I think what Peter's saying about that these nations were at war almost all the time is very critical. And I'll just add a couple of other things to what Peter said. One's about St. Martin. St. Martin lived a little bit before St. Augustine, so his example was in there, although I think they were contemporaries for part of their life. St. Martin was the first, he was nonviolent, but he was also the first saint of the Christian church that was not a martyr, and it was in the 300s, so almost all of the saints ahead of that died a violent death. And so, but St. Martin, for those of you who aren't familiar with him, is the one who's known for, you know, being in his soldier's thing and seeing a man shivering to death and taking his cloak and cutting it in half and giving half of it to the beggar. That's his image that is always used to identify him. That was when he was a young man as a Roman soldier, and he started at, say, 13, 14, and he was a Christian. His mother was a Christian, but his father was an officer in the Roman army and not a Christian. So he was still a teenager when he did this, and he was jailed for his or exiled, I suppose is the best. He was put off on one of the islands off of the Italian coast for a couple of years. But eventually, people came to him, and he eventually became a bishop in what's now Tours. France, and that's why he's known as Martin of Tours, because he was a bishop there. And he lived to be about 80, and he spent most of his life as a bishop somewhat not on purpose. He was kind of dragged into it a little bit. But he negotiated a lot of treaties. And one of the treaties that he negotiated was between one of the heresies, the heretical bishops, and the Christian bishops that had the Orthodox point of view, because most people wanted just to kill the heretics, and he thought that might not be necessary.
Augustine was one of those people.
Yes, exactly. Now, Augustine, the other thing I say about Augustine, you know, to give a little background on him, I mean, he's famous for, you know, for saying, you know, God grant me chastity, but not yet. It's because as a young man, he was not a Christian, but he became a Christian, then he became a bishop. Although he's identified with the Roman Empire, he's actually was in Hippo, right?
Hippo.
And which is on the North African coast. And therefore, he was in one of the provinces. He was a provincial leader. But the other thing that's very interesting about St. Augustine is that he was a Manichaean before he became a Christian. And the Manichaeans looked at the world as a fight between good and evil, black and white. This is, you know, the good angels and the bad angels. And the whole world was in this fight, and human beings were just pawns in this fight, sort of, so to speak. And that not only influenced his ideas on warfare, I'm sure, but it influenced all of Christianity as a result of his great influence on that. So
great.
Those were my additions.
Great. International agreements like the Geneva Conventions take a legalistic approach to controlling war. How can they clarify whether war is morally justifiable?
Well, we have to first of all see the continuity that there's a man, if you're talking about an international law, first of all, there are two kinds of ways that law impinges on the thing. There's what you call in war theory the laws ad bellum about when you can declare a war, and then there are also the laws in bello, how you fight a war once a war has been declared. And both grow out of the tradition of St. Thomas, and there are many, many names that we're not mentioning. And then in the Renaissance, when you start to get a difference between Catholics and Protestants, you get a secular body of international law trying to cover them both. And the name that we think of here is Hugo Grotius, Grotius. And I think that once you have a legal framework, and I think enormous progress. This is a very worrisome century we're in, but it's also one where we can look with some satisfaction at the progress that has been made in international law. I mean, wars are increasingly becoming the exception. They increasingly are farther and farther apart. And the downside to that is that they can be much worse than they ever were before when they happen. So you had the 30 Years' War, and then you had the Napoleonic Wars, World War I, World War II. And I think we're very lucky that the world hasn't blown itself up in the nuclear era since World War II. So the international law has become a terribly important priority now, and any war has to be looked at in that context. So I'm going to address really the ad bellum aspect of it. It seems to me quite clear that America may or may not have fought a defensible war in Korea because America was not the aggressor here. But I throw it out to you that in my belief, every war that America has fought since Korea, starting with Vietnam, but involving from the little ones like Grenada up to the huge, disastrous ones like Iraq, they've been bad for America in every sense, but they've also been immoral and they've been illegal. And none more conspicuously than the war in Iraq, which they got a resolution into the UN Assembly. That's not how you make war under the UN Charter. You go to the Security Council. And America didn't, because it wanted to fight a war which it knew was illegal. All the jurists of the world are combined in an international commission, and they warned Bush before the war not only that it was illegal, but that he would become a war criminal if he fought it. And you may notice that George Bush and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld don't travel abroad very much, because there are countries where they risk being arrested as war criminals. And we should think about that. I'm not sure it's very helpful to say that criminal George Bush, as people often do. But I think the point I want to make is that now we have a frail, fallible system of international law. It becomes much more difficult to imagine when and how to fight, And then there are other charters besides the UN Charter, the Human Rights Charter and so on. They got violated too, but I'll just stick with the UN Charter because that's so important to me as a former diplomat, a former Canadian diplomat, and our foreign policy was strengthen the UN.
Yeah, I think it's very tricky to use the word illegal because there. Speaking as a lawyer, because the international law is voluntary. It's not really a law yet. So I'm going to make a distinction slightly between what Peter said and what I would think about this subject, in spite of the fact that the conclusions are fairly similar. And that is this framework that has been put up is done by all the nations who really have sovereignty, saying the United Nations is what we're going to use to try to solve problems. We're going to have an international court of justice. A lot of international institutions have been set up, but none of those institutions have sovereignty. It'd be like if we had our national government was there, but the states had the sovereignty and the national government had no sovereignty, really. And this was the problem at the beginning of America for the first 10 years or 15 years, that this is difficult to have. Now, I think it's a little early in our creation of a world culture, probably, to have a sovereign world government, because it would look too much like the mafia, and 95% of our other institutions have looked for all of history. But I have confidence that a couple hundred years from now, when democracy has sunk in a lot more and we're not so authoritarian and not so just using the mafia approach to creating things, that we will have a chance of creating international institutions that have some sovereignty, and I think it probably will be a gradual process. And international law in the last century is the first steps along this path, I think. So I can understand why the president might have decided that this wasn't going to get in his way in order to accomplish his goals.
Kick some ass.
Yeah. But what's interesting to me is a slightly different point of view. The laws about what you can and can't do were really quite useful, and they got started because of the use of gas in World War I. Is that right? The Geneva on what you do in war. Yeah, we haven't talked about those. But
the things about laws in
the laws in what you can do while you're in a war. Of course, this is being ignored by lots of players now, too. So all of these things are suggestions. What we're trying to do is we're extrapolating. This is the way I feel about it. We're extrapolating from our social city-state approach to subjects and seeing whether we can do that on the international level. Our city-state approach, as we know, that we can't let everyone do anything that they want to anytime they want to. You know, we've learned that. Now, what have we learned about how to prevent the worst things from happening? That's the question. I mean, it's all the question about, do we deal with terrorists as if it's a police action or if it's a war against them? That's one of the parts of this whole argument, because if we look at it from a police action point of view, we're saying, we can't get rid of, in our city state, we cannot get rid of murder. We cannot get rid of rape. We cannot get rid of theft. Can't get rid of prostitution. There's a lot of things we can't get rid of, right? But what laws can we create that will minimize these problems, make them happen less often? That's really what we're after. We kind of have an idea that it would take a long time and a lot of education before we got rid of them. So now we're extrapolating, I think, from that success, because the city states have definitely succeeded in making our lives much less violent, much less stressful. You can live at home. You can even not lock your doors. A lot of people, you know, most people do, but you can not lock your doors. Still not have anybody break in, do violence to you. Maybe you might have a couple break-ins to steal things, but this is so way down from the way it was 400 or 500 years ago, so and prior to that. So we're successful, but we pay attention to the laws as opposed to the overall policy of getting people to agree to live by the laws. And that's the first step in any good law is, and this is something I'll talk about next time with Moore and Utopia. You know, one of the things that he says is that the laws should be simple, straightforward, and easy for everyone to agree that that's a good idea, because then people will follow them. People will agree to them, at least 80, 90% of the people will. And if you get that, that's great. You know, the tax law, everyone complains about the tax law, but Americans in general,
abide by it to 80, 90%, something like that. Of course, there's plenty of cheaters, but it's a lot easier to deal with the problem of 10 to 20% cheaters than in Italy, where it seems to be, you know, 60, 70, 80% of the people cheat on their taxes. And so there's that issue, this issue of law. And so I go back now to President Bush and his decisions. His decisions were based on what he wanted to accomplish. And I always go back to that with everything that we're doing. What are we trying to accomplish by creating these laws, by trying to bring war to an end or try to bring war within a certain framework, you know, so that, you know, if you can't stop people from murdering, can you stop them from murdering in certain ways, or do you punish certain things worse than others? You know, right now we're punishing crimes, murders, other crimes against people of other races more than a normal one because of that extra element involved, that extra passion which our society is trying to tamp down. We do the same thing for gender reasons also, or towards your sexual orientation, because we're trying to tamp down the way society feels about these differences, and so we're adding extra punishment onto those. There's nothing rational or logical or fair about that. It's simply that that's our goal, and therefore we're using this as a means to that goal. So in the international community on international law, we have used this as an attempt to say, you know, however much you are admired in your own country, if you step outside your own country because you have behaved this way, you're going to not be admired. You're going to be – it happens the other way, too. I mean, Mikhail Gorbachev is a good example. You know, he was admired for what he did from the West, but he was not admired by the Russians. You know, 1% of the Russians like what he did because he ruined their country as far as they're concerned. So this whole approach of admiration is also fraught with difficulties. So there's lots of different things that we can do. But right now we're just setting up goals and we're calling them laws, but they're not mandatory yet. So if I go back to the recent laws, I mean the recent wars that we undertook, I would say, you know, how clever were they in trying to achieve their goals? It's another part of the thing. What was their goal and did they get close to achieving it? I find the biggest difference in current warfare is that if you go back a couple hundred years and certainly before that, most of it was domination. The wars were there for domination or theft. Mm-hmm. And so that was your goal. Your goal was, you know, it's easier to go out in the springtime, beat up your neighbors, take their wives and children instead of, you know, creating your own crops or whatever. You know, it's just easier to get rich that way than anything else. Well, you know, the Industrial Revolution has put paid to that idea. And the expensive war has also, you know, I mean, it's always been expensive. But now it's so expensive, it costs you more than it costs your enemy to carry on the war, right? And so if you win, it's cost you more to win against somebody than to dominate them. So we have a different set of goals. Now we have closer to humanitarian goals, a little bit closer in line with at least stated. There's always other goals. Yes. You know, and everyone knows it's the fashion to have the humanitarian goal, and so that's the one that's stated. But we know that there's, you know, and it's kind of funny, but at the same time, we all know, if we are honest with ourselves, that whenever we do something that seems to be humanitarian in our own personal lives, we probably have another 10 or 15 reasons for doing that moves it over the line and makes it why we do that one rather than something else. Because there's always a wide range of motives for everything that we do. But this interest is, you know, you say, what's the goal? So let's pick out one of those wars for just a second, and that's George H.W. Bush's war against Iraq because they took over Kuwait. Well, there were lots of other reasons for doing it, but they didn't jump into it. They talked to everybody. They got this whole coalition together, which was pretty hard to do, and then they attacked, and then they pushed back, and then they said, we're not going to go in. It was very interesting, by the way, since you mentioned Cheney. There's a 1994 interview with Cheney 2 years after he was defense secretary, asking him, why didn't you go in and take out Saddam Hussein? You should have just kept going. I mean, you guys were winning. Why did you stop at the border? And he gave very cogent reasons of why that wasn't a good idea. Every single one of those reasons he ignored, 10 years later, in pushing for the war on Iraq. And every single thing that he had as cogent reasons in 94 came true. Basically, right?
Can we say a bit? Yeah. Can I come back on
yeah,
that?
Yeah, please, yeah.
Because I agree, if you're going to make an exception, yeah, there was one just war, that would be the candidate. But I, even then, I think that America's goals, stated goals, were all satisfied when they put troops into Saudi Arabia,
right,
and then liberated Kuwait. You know, that
right.
The actual fighting of the war, I don't think, was necessary for the American goals.
I agree with that. I also think one of the worst things, I mean, I was very happy. I was not happy, surprised at how well that was organized. And he showed his diplomatic and CIA background and how he got that whole thing together. But he also showed them when, you know, in the last days when the army was going back to Iraq, that they killed like 200 people in a day on the road going back. They just killed everybody that was going back on the road. And in addition to that, then they stirred up the Kurds and the Shias to revolt and then didn't do anything about it. There's a whole bunch of things.
Yes.
And in addition to that, and then he said, you know, we really kicked ass, which I think was about the stupidest thing, you know, that was said, because it's not a football game, you know. It's not a football game. It's something a little bit more serious than that. But you know, maybe those are quibbles about it, but you still say, what are the goals and what do we do to achieve it? So I'm going to go back to that main point, and which is our stated goals are really not to dominate anymore. We've become smart, and this is one of the things that has happened.
I'm not sure that's true, George.
You don't think that's true?
I didn't bring it, but I had a quote from Thomas Barnett, a professor at the Naval War College, and therefore not just a professor.
Mm-hmm.
We're useless professors, but a professor who's part of the system. And he said very clearly in his book that the goal of American policy, we are the core of civilization, and those people out there are not civilized yet, and it is our job to bring civilization to the rest of the world. Well, that's code for America being the world policeman. And the world policeman means that America is no longer under the rule of law. It is making the rule of law. And Truman and his team had the wisdom back in 1945 to say, yes, we're very powerful right now. We want to subject our power to international law. That's the UN Charter, Chapter 7, very specific on how you make war. And nowadays we just ignore it.
Right.
And this is a terrible, I think, decline from America at its best in 1945.
Oh, I agree completely. It's
agreed.
Very interesting, too, from a philosophical point of view, since I've got this part of the series, it's very interesting to me what ideas are at play, because a lot of people don't realize how fundamental ideas in our culture are really driving a large number of those decisions. And this attitude, both the attempt to put ourselves, our power in, that's the democratic impulse. That's the impulse of saying, when we dominate, we don't even do as well as when we don't dominate, when we cooperate, when we trade, and so on and so forth. That we've learned, but not everybody has learned it. In fact, very few people have learned it. There's only a few people, and unfortunately, a lot of them don't end up in power, but when they do and they have an influence, they have to fight lots of people in order to try to get those things in, right? I mean, they need political skill, which requires them to fight, to talk about not fighting. So it's a very unusual combination. There's General Marshall being one of the examples. I mean, he was a general, so he knew how to fight, but he was fighting for this other idea. But this other idea about being the world's policeman is just a continuation of the white man's burden. You know, this idea that mm-hmm. the British had and other people had, that the world is uncivilized and we have to go around. And I think the best answer to that is Gandhi's, which is, you know, India ruled badly by Indians is better than India ruled well by the British. So
he was also asked what he thought of Western civilization. He said he thought it was a good idea.
Building on that idea about civilization and state actors being the genesis for some of these international agreements and norms and institutions, let me talk about non-state actors for a moment. Mm-hmm. Now, we know that non-state actors are not signatories to international conventions, except for some NGOs that are observers with the UN and other bodies. And yet the Islamic State, in particular, revels in egregious violations of Western notions of morality on the battlefield. They execute people, they rape women, they smash cultural artifacts, they do a lot of things that we in the Anglo-Saxon West would regard, from an ethnocentric standpoint at least, as very bad things. How can the international community compel these non-state groups to adhere to moral norms in warfare?
Well, we were sent these questions ahead, and this was the first time. I thought these were excellent questions, but for the first time I took issue with the wording of the last sentence in this one, which I will repeat, and I think the issue here is very important. How can the international community compel non-state groups to adhere to moral norms in warfare? Now, I see two things wrong with this formulation. And the first one is that it's much too limited. How do you get non-state groups to agree to anything? Because, you know, if you start negotiating with the Taliban right away, the Taliban splits in two, and one part, you know, one of the advantages of suggesting negotiations is that some of the Taliban start killing the other Taliban and do our work for us. But this is not really a solution. And this is a very, very major problem. And then we come to what I think is the real root error or problem with this formulation is you're not going to get what you want by trying to compel non-state groups. You can maybe, you know, you can do massive bombing, you can do all kinds of things, but your goal is to achieve peace in that area. And we're going to come to techniques like drones later on, so I won't talk too much about that now. But the problem is that they are there as a non-state group because they object to the West pushing their country around. There is not one, you know, what non-state groups are we talking about? We're talking about people in Palestine, in Libya, in Syria, in Iraq, in Afghanistan. And when the press talk about them, they look at them, they're all Muslim. But they're a tiny part of the global Muslim religion. They're all in areas which America has been invading, and that's why they're there. Now, in the case of Palestine, nobody can talk in one afternoon about Palestine, and it's not essentially America's problem. But the other ones, very much, we created those groups, and we have to accept that. And I saw an article in the New York Times in December, and it was started on page one. It was a major article. On page 15, the prose was that it was talking about two warriors who started fighting back in Anbar province as part of the crucible where ISIS, I say Daesh, but ISIS will do, where ISIS was formed, reaching back more than a decade. It's perfectly obvious if anyone looks at it. We have Daesh because we invaded Iraq and fought the Iraq war with a lot of techniques which totally violated the Geneva Conventions. And we then left Iraq with a very alienated Sunni group who had used to being in power. Maybe they didn't deserve to be in power. They're certainly not a majority. But they were totally alienated from America, and they're willing to die. And I have to say, so to sum up my point, when you have large numbers of people who support a movement, who volunteer to be part of the movement, who are willing to die for that movement and volunteer themselves as suicide bombers for that movement, then you are dealing with a movement that has to be taken seriously. If you believe in bringing the world more and more into one world, you have to respect that group as being something that has to be negotiated with and not just compelled. Now, this is very difficult to accept because, as you said, that the things they do are deliberately done to shock us. Beheadings, rapes, persecutions of minorities, the list is very long. But you have to understand, this is revolutionary judo. They are doing this in order to get us to go and fight them because that's how they're going to win. Mm-hmm. And if we don't fight them, it will not be the same situation at all. So that's why I say I take issue with that one sentence.
I'll go at it from a different point of view, which is going back to my idea about goals. Let's go back to the idea that the goal is a world culture where there's much more peace than there is today and so on and so forth. How are we going to get there? People don't talk about the steps. Again, they just say we want peace. You know, I mean, it's a little bit embarrassing to point out how few families actually can get along for weeks at a time without some kind of altercation. So that's within one household. So now we're talking about the whole world. So I think we should at least be modest about what we're going to try to achieve. But it seems to me that we can accomplish this by going one step at a time. And the most important step, I think, is to first set the goal of what you want to eradicate from human culture in order to make this possible. And the first thing is slavery. The first thing is taking people's, you know, ability to make their own decisions away from them. Because there's no way that this can be accomplished as long as any large numbers. I mean, it will not be eliminated. But this is the thing when it's legalized slavery. This is the kind of thing. But what we do, it's so tempting when we start doing this to say, oh, you don't do this right, or you don't do this kind of democracy. Well, just say you're not democratic, and therefore we're going to make you Democrats, you know, and make you have a democratic country. You know, but what if we created all democratic countries and then we said, well, now we don't think your elections are fair enough because we think that the ballot boxes are stuffed too much. And, you know, and if we do that for long enough, we're going to catch up to our own misdeeds in that and find out that we're not democratic either. So it's an interesting process of saying you're going to take your ideas that you feel were really successful and put them on some other culture. Now, it may very well be that the ideas you have are really much more valuable, and I tend to think that way about Western culture. But I also think that it can't be done by demanding it. It's interesting. It's also a little bit like a parental. I mean, you're taking this policeman role, this parental role in the world. You know, it's like parents who the thing that made them happy was that they were Lutheran. So then they really want their children to be Lutheran. They think that's the thing that made them happy, and they have five children, and two of them are Lutheran, and two of them become a different thing, and one of them becomes a Hindu. And the Hindu turns out to be the happiest of the lot, but the parents can never see that because, you know, that's not what they expected. And so why I point out slavery as the thing, if free will is actually the positive end of that. That if we respect free will, the more and more we respect free will, and not an absolute respect for free will, because you can't allow things in any society where people use their free will to intimidate other people's free will or to take it away. That's the theft and rape and murder sort of actions. No society will ever tolerate that, most likely. The Wild West did. It tolerated a certain amount of murder and so on and so forth because you couldn't put everybody in prison who committed murder. So there are always civilizations, if you can be called that, that have accepted a certain amount of these things. But I think that's the way to approach it and to say, you know, if you're going to compel anybody, then you get everybody on board that says, okay, there's not going to be any more slavery. And then you probably would get 90% of the countries to agree with that. And then you could move that off the table. It would probably take 50 years, but then you move it off the table and you say, okay, what's the next thing we're going to try to get rid of? But as I said, it's too tempting for the people who are in power and have the better weapons to say, yes, we're going to remake the world, but we're going to remake it in my image. Everything look exactly like it does in our mirror. No, we really, really, I don't think want to see that happen. It's enough to just look in our own mirror and see what's there, not to see the whole world reflected back to us.
Exactly. Speaking of mirrors, that's a technology, but there are other technologies too. Some new technologies like drones and blinding lasers and computer viruses bring new challenges for military commanders in determining rules of engagement. And these technologies have both lethal and non-lethal effects. What moral challenges come with these new methods of conducting war?
Well, you've given a wide range of technologies. I'd like to talk about drones because that's, I think, one where the issues are simple. The problem is with drones, the root problem is, every time you kill a terrorist, you've created another terrorist. And you have to know how drones work. I mean, they're getting more, the technology keeps changing, but in the old days, a neighborhood could hear a drone coming. It was like, you know, some people may remember World War II, and in the last year of that war, the British were subjected to V1s and V2s. Now, the rockets that really did the damage were the V2s. They went way up and came way down and a huge smash. The V1s were relatively primitive and rickety, and they came along horizontally making a terrible noise as it went. Everyone wanted to know where they're going to land. The V1s terrorized far more people than the V2s did. The people who were terrorized by the V2s were dead. people terrorized by the V1s were reignited in their hatred of Germany. Well, this is, I'm afraid, is what a lot of the drones are doing. And I'm not up to the minute on drone technology, but there are whole areas, particularly in the Fatah area of Pakistan, where people pray. Everybody prays for a cloudy day, as somebody reminded me this morning. They pray for a cloudy day because that means that the drones won't be able to fly over the area and start killing people. And here, I think one can distinguish perhaps between the CIA and the military. The military maybe go to more schools about just war. And I think in Syria, they try, if possible, to target a moving vehicle. Even in a moving vehicle, there's going to be more than the target you want, maybe only one or two. But in Pakistan, they target a compound. And the social structure of Pakistan is that families live in compounds, and families are not nuclear families, parents and children. They're extended families, so that the percentage of collateral damage, particularly in the CIA use of weapons, is very high. In my last book, The American Deep State, the last chapter is about America's self-generating wars. And I can't give you all the arguments in that thing. I'll just focus on the drones. We're using drones more and more and more. And you read in the papers it's to go after significant targets like Jihad John or somebody like that. No, it's so convenient. It's so easy. It's so safe for the people doing it that it's being used more and more and more for all kinds of targets, including low-level drug dealers, which was not in the original conception at all. I'd like to read a bit from the New York Times because I think it sums it up pretty well. First of all, the idea, you know, you set out your goals, as you call them, and this is the Times. Mr. Obama had approved not only personality strikes aimed at named high-value terrorists, but signature strikes that targeted training camps and suspicious compounds in areas controlled by militants. Well, the policy is limited. The policy makes a certain sense. Next paragraph of the Times, but some State Department officials, so this is not me, this is people inside the government. Officials have complained to the White House that the criteria used by the CIA for identifying a terrorist signature were too lax. The joke was that when CIA sees three guys doing jumping jacks, the agency thinks it's a terrorist training camp. And one senior official, men loading a truck with fertilizer could be bomb makers, but they might also be farmers, skeptics argued. And then there are the double taps where the family members, friends, or neighbors who try to rescue someone hit by a drone missile are themselves targeted for assassination. And the famous video which moved Chelsea Manning to go public with documents was not just of a van being blown up in an Iraqi city, but the doctor who came to deal with the thing, with his own family. They blew him up too, and the man doing it was laughing in the helicopter because one other factor you just know, you dehumanize people in warfare, and we should not forget this. So I am totally against any use of drones that has not been debated at, shall we say, the UN Security Council level. I'm not ruling it out altogether. It is being terribly misused at present. It is creating the wars that we're there to fight.
I think what you said about the helicopter pilot, I think should be matched with Osama bin Laden and his team laughing. I mean, this is what irritated everybody after 9/11, besides the fact that 9/11 was to get this video of them laughing about what they had done. And I think this is, as you say, Peter, this is all part of the dehumanizing of war and making it into a sport and everything. I think if it's taken very seriously, that there's a whole range of decisions that can be made that people in their own free will think this is the right decision under the circumstances for my goals. And then you have to step back and say, you know, how effectively are we going to move forward with civilization with that range? The goals for the drones, though, it's very interesting. Obviously, there are some very moral goals for that. That is to protect our own soldiers, to protect our side of the fight. All weaponry is designed to protect your side of the fight and make you more effective in war. And obviously, no matter how strong your soldiers were, and I mean, there was Goliath versus David, you know, and David got the slingshot, and that was it for the big guy. But the big difference over time has often been technological, and it's not just our recent technology, but you know, the long bows, et cetera, have always, there's always been something that has given one side an advantage. Now we have a tremendous advantage, you know, with our technology. There's no question about it. Now, how do we use that? And how do we use that maybe not even so much anymore morally for this question as to line up with our goals? Our goals are to try to put, you know, an end to terrorism or an end to the group that's sponsoring terrorism or an end to the group that wants to take over Afghanistan and put all the women out of education because our women don't want that to happen. And a lot of men don't want that to happen. No, a lot of people don't want it to happen. So we're going against cultural norms in those countries and saying this is our goal. This is what we want to accomplish. So we have to step back, I think, and say we're not going to take over Afghanistan and run it and dominate it. Maybe it's true, but I don't see why, given its history, anybody would ever really want to do that. But if we're not doing that, then we have to look at it and try to look at it from their point of view, as you said. People down on the ground praying for cloudy days. Now, I'm going to switch for just a second to the images that we have in our culture. How many movies are out there about an attack on planet Earth, you know, from outer space, from aliens or this, that other thing? What do the aliens always do? They always come with really cool technology, and they always kill us all before we have any chance because we can't figure out their technology, and we think it's a really unfair fight. And then Clint Eastwood or Tom Cruise or somebody figures some little virus out or accidentally implants them with the virus, and they all die at the last second without us really realizing how we did it because we don't have the technology. That's the dream. There was something in The Economist years ago which I thought was just the greatest short description of what goes on in Hollywood. It said that Hollywood gives us our dreams and takes our dreams and our nightmares and gives them back to us with bigger budgets and better bodies. And I think that these movies are really clear of how people are going to see us using drones and high technology. They're going to see us as the aliens too far away. In the old days, you know, I mean, if someone, you know, it's like in the old westerns or when Indiana Jones meets the guy in the bazaar that has his knife and swings it around and then he just shoots him. It's like, you're not playing fair. You're not being a man. You're not fighting man to man. You're not doing it fair. And this is certainly exactly the same. You want to win, of course. But it's certainly the same result is going to happen in these countries the more we go. And you don't think the criminals will feel the same way if the drones are used here in the United States against organized crime? And wait a minute. We were able to pay off all kinds of people. Now you got drones on us and we don't have anybody to pay off anymore because we don't know who's operating these things. So I think there's both sides to the story. There's morality on both sides of the drones. But I think from a goal point of view, we're going to make ourselves into those technologically advanced aliens. And this is really not the way we're going to build a human world culture. I just think it's going to be counterproductive on that scale.
Perhaps an international convention on new technologies like drones would be useful in getting nation states to agree on appropriate rules for use.
Yeah. I think, you know, going back to the point earlier, all the international conventions, I think, would work a lot better if people didn't aim for the skies with what we're going to agree on in the environment or anything, but said, what's the lowest common denominator that we can all agree on, you know, and then make that step. And once we've got that in place and we move forward on that one, then say, okay, well, that wasn't so hard. What's the next step? Because we don't walk anywhere the way we're doing, basically. You know, I mean, we can, certain number of people adopt the high end of the ideas, but not enough to put an end to anything. Yeah.
I wish I'd said earlier, it was what I really believe, and I haven't said it. Nowadays, these things are so complicated, we have to approach all of these problems, all of the eight questions here at once, and think about things holistically. And particularly, why are we fighting Daesh? And I agree with you about our goals. Why are we fighting Daesh? Is it because we want to be we want to place Britain, you know, for a long time maintained whatever order, and it wasn't very much, in the Middle East, and starting in the 70s with the Carter Doctrine, America's moved in and sort of played that role. But it's never really been debated. Do we want to be the regional power in the Middle East? Because as long as we want that, or look as if we want it, you're going to have people like ISIS, Daesh, who are doing shocking things in order to make us fight them, because they see that they'll only get us out by getting the war so big that we in America will not want to go on fighting it. And so we have the big thing when we think holistically is you cannot just say this group is a non-state group, it's behaving illegally, and we are going to figure out how to get rid of it. No, you have to think politically, and that's why I say you have to respect them and work. In the end, the goal is to be working with them and not against them.
Right. And so as a goal like that, and if the United States, if the real goal is, you know, a world culture we can get along better, then we have to go along with that, with means that create that possible outcome. And in this case, you know, we're not really here to debate foreign policy. But it's very, you know, in our moving towards that goal over the next few centuries, it seems that we should learn something that was learned long ago by some people, which is the worst foreign policy is when you make yourself the common enemy of groups that otherwise would never get along.
Well said.
At this time, I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to a panel discussion on the morality of warfare at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. I do have other prepared questions, but I would like to hear from the audience, too. If any audience members have any questions, there's a microphone set up in the back.
The microphone is right back there. We'd like to record everything. So either someone can hand it to you, or yeah, that'd be great. Thank you. Is it turned on? Yeah, great.
Yeah, this might seem a little long-winded, but I'm getting to a point that I'm reading a great book called The Edge of the World about Northern Europe in the 8th, 9th, 10th, 12th, 11th, 12th century. And one of the theses of this particular book is that the Vikings and their maraudings was so bad that when they came to the city-state, this is when rules of war engagement first took place. Chivalry, you don't enslave people, you don't rape women, you don't destroy churches, you know, maybe you should fight mano a mano thing. And so the question I'm leading is, it seems to me that the Geneva Convention is written in invisible ink. And I'd like your opinion about whether the Geneva Convention is actually applicable now, and what does it really accomplish?
I think the Geneva Conventions worked quite well in World War II in solving the problems of World War I. So we did not have gas warfare in World War II. The big problem now is you're dealing with the non-state groups. We live under what's called the Westphalian system, established after the 30 Years' War. You divide the world up into nation states, and the principle is you don't invade them unless they are aggressive, and the UN Charter spells out the conditions. The Third World sees that system as the system that permitted colonial expansion all over the world. In Africa, the lines dividing up the nation states in northern Africa were drawn in Berlin by people who did not speak the local language. One of the problems in Afghanistan, as we were saying earlier, is that the Durand Line, which is convenient in terms of military domination because one side of the mountains was Britain and the other side of the mountains wasn't, but you were dividing not just tribes and nationalities but families in two by doing this. And so I think we have to accept that in the world we're in now, the Westphalian system is no longer a sacred thing which we should try to impose because it has been wildly abused in Central Asia, in Africa. And I'll just limit it to those two.
Yeah. I think one of the things that's important, again, with the goal, the long-term goal being a better world culture for humanity, is to think we can't just start with the thing that solves the problem. So the Geneva Convention brought a lot of ideas to light that people then discussed. And it, and if the only effect was that it was embarrassing for a party to violate that convention and that you're not in the club anymore of the civilized world, that that did damp down a certain amount of bad behavior. And one of the elements is torture. You know, you don't torture people. And this is something that, that a lot of civilizations, yes, we know under duress we're going to want to, but we're going to say we're not going to do it. Okay. Now, we ourselves under duress have maybe, maybe not, people argue about it, but we certainly got walked awfully close to the line if we didn't go over it. And we lost moral standing as a result. I mean, Turkey was kept out of Europe for all, you know, for the last 50, 60 years. On that one, not one, but the main point was that everybody knew that they tortured. Now, everyone knows that at some places in local communities and so on, that some policemen will torture and so on and so forth. You know, that, that that's understood. The difference is, do the leaders say this is one of our implements that we're going to use as a policy of our state? And so, you know, nobody has ever said that in America because they said, no, we didn't do that. We got a lawyer to say that it wasn't and so on and so forth. So we tried to toe the line. But the moral effect of that legality was that we blurred the line, at the very least. We blurred the line. And that didn't make us look good. And that has undercut our ability to create this. But at the same time, you know, the UN, a lot of people say, well, the UN has been wasted because we didn't hasn't really done that much. But we don't know what would have happened without it. We never can know that. It's not bad, even if all it did is create a place in New York where people from all over come and talk and talk and talk and talk and nothing ever gets done, but at least they're talking, you know?
Yeah, so I want to put in a word for the UN.
Yeah.
In 1956, you had a war between Israel and Palestine, and the UN went in and says, I'm mentioning this because Canada sponsored the resolution. they put in a UNEF, an expeditionary force, which created a kind of ceasefire in that area. And now the relationship between Israel and Egypt is better than with any of their other partners, neighbors. So it we mustn't just write off the
UN and
say it didn't do anything. It did many things.
I was quoting other people, not myself. I was saying even if that was all it did, it would still be useful. Even if all the Geneva Convention did was set this standard and say that would be a good idea if we did that. But it's done much more in both cases. And I think they're both, you know, more than good first steps. It's very easy to be upset when we compare what's going on to our imaginations of how we think it could be. But it's a lot more, you get much more optimistic if you compare it to what else has happened, what else has gone on in the world, what's a realistic appraisal of how people have behaved under duress, under difficult circumstances. And I think it's also very important, I think, from a military point of view, the U.S. military, the British military, other militaries that have set very high codes of conduct for themselves. You know, they don't always live up to that code, but that code is why things work better for our foreign policy and for achieving our goals whenever they live up to those things. There's no question that the reason that America was so influential in Western Europe after World War II was that our soldiers behaved themselves relatively well while they were fighting that war for the local population. So the local populations were now willing to say, okay, well, we're being dominated by the Americans. But, you know, they left our girls alone, or mostly sometimes left our girls alone, you know. I'm not saying never. But, you know, all you have to do is, unfortunately, it's a little like that bear joke, you know. You don't have to run faster than the bear. You only have to run faster than your companion, who the bear is chasing. And in this case, the bear was the Russians. And, you know, compared to the Russians, everybody was very happy with how everybody else behaved after World War II. So, you know, it really is a matter of winning hearts and minds in this case if we're trying for those goals. And it doesn't have to be perfect behavior. But if you have a set of rules and you follow them and people see that, there may be a certain number of people in other countries who laugh at you for following such rules under the circumstances of a war. But you have another big part of the population that says they're somewhat trustworthy. That's unusual.
Yes, ma'am. You have a question?
Okay. I'm not quite sure how to start this, but you mentioned before that if goals are your intentions are just in going to war and also to have goals. I think that the United States right now, it's my opinion, that our goals, our objectives, are not quite that altruistic. I think for many years, probably at least since the end of World War II, a lot of the things that we do is really based on economics rather than trying to dominate or just have power. I think, especially since the fall of the Soviet Union, we have decided to just go in and be the world dominator. And I think what's happened is that I don't think the elected officials, the president, really has that much control over what we're going to do. I believe right now that the CIA, the other government, and all of our corporate interests, which pretty much with their money dominate our, well, everything, the Supreme Court, the Congress, everything, I think that they're the ones that really call the shots. And the reason that we started all these wars with whatever excuses or reasons we gave was because of an economic thing. They want the oil. They wanted to dominate this. They're going to fight at the Arctic to drill there. I mean, how would you respond to that?
I would say one thing, and that is, you know, if you're looking for reasons to hope that we will ever create, you know, this world culture or a better world culture instead of just doing things by, I think you have to compare the 20th century to the one before and so on. And you can do a big broad brush and say, it might not be in the warfare area, but the Earth supported 2 billion people in 1900, and it supported 6 billion people in the year 2000. So we did something right. We were able to triple the number of people on the planet that were living somewhat. Now, a lot of those people are living badly, but for all of history, a lot of people have lived badly. The other thing that I have to say about that is, when somebody wants to accomplish something, what are the motives that they say they're doing it for, and what are their real ones? It's true when you date people. It's true all the time, right? There's always something else going on. But the motives that you say out loud are the socially acceptable motives. So at least these motives have become socially acceptable. It used to be that no one ever bothered to try to hide behind socially acceptable motives for creating a war. They just said, we want it, we're going in, and we're taking it. And so at least we've come that far. That's not really enough to make everybody really happy, but it is a sign that we're moving in the direction that could create this thing that most of us really want.
Doesn't it look like we're heading more into a 1984 situation where there are wars going on all over the place? Everybody hears about it, but nobody really cares anymore.
Well, your question is very close to my view of things. And I wrote a book, The American Deep State, which is saying, although you have people in the White House who say we want to do this, they are indeed not totally free. I say in one of my books, there's a mindset in Washington, and the president doesn't set the mindset. The mindset chooses the president.
Yes.
And I think we have to begin with that. I don't want to summarize my book, but yes, Iraq, you know, we said it was to bring democracy to Iraq. And we were relying on a man called Shalabi that we knew was a liar, knew was a crook, but he was very convenient. So they were going to call it Operation Iraqi Liberation. And then they said, wait a minute, Operation Iraqi Liberation, O-I-L. I don't think we went to use that. Yet the fact that they had to do that thinking means that, yes, everybody knew that there were reasons for going into Iraq, which were never being mentioned. And that is true of every war. So that's what makes me a little nervous about your approach to things, George, because, you know, you're stating these goals and so on. The goals can be fine, but the reality is not the goals.
No, so, absolutely not.
I better shut up because I would talk for the next 30 minutes.
But I knew the deep state thing. But you could also tell, you know, show that I'm not fooled by these motives that are said rather than the real ones any more than when someone wants to date you for the same reason. You shouldn't be fooled by these fake motives. I mean, You could tell it was a sales job because one of the things they said when they said they were going to, you know, create a Muslim democracy, we need to create a Muslim democracy so other people in that area find out what it could be like. You know, there's Turkey is right there. You know, and Indonesia is you know, not that far away. It's really big. And India, it has 300 million Muslims in it, and it's a democracy. So saying we need to create a Muslim democracy was one of the ineffective.
Disingenuous is an appropriate word.
Sales jobs I'd ever heard. I couldn't believe that nobody said, well, wait a minute, aren't there some other? I thought that Turkey was going to say, wait a minute, did you forget me?
Indonesia happens to be the largest Muslim country population-wise
exactly.
in the
yeah,
world.
Yeah. There's lots
it's
of examples. And we don't even have to include Egypt in its sort of semi-pretend democracy either. You know, so there was plenty of examples of the range of democracy in the Muslim world. And so it was a really, really strange thing to say. I thought, I don't know who sold them that line, but
not me. Sir, yeah, of course.
You've talked about a number of wars, and I do remember the Second World War. My father fought in the First World War, and the Third War that I'd like to just touch on briefly was Charlie Wilson's war, the Afghanistan CIA war. One of the differences, it seems to me, after World War I, we were into retribution, punishing the Germans. After World War II, we had the Marshall Plan. And the thing that strikes me is that there's now no real likelihood that we would lose a war. The earlier wars, there was some chance, at least in people's minds, that we wouldn't beat Hitler, that we wouldn't, I mean, you know, the British stood for 2 years while we armed them. But so part of the planning now has to include what you do when you win. Yes. And you know, Charlie Wilson's famous quote that, you know, these things are wonderful and they change the world. And then, and I'll edit it a little. And then we didn't follow through. We didn't have an end game, and that seems to me the part that's missing in all of these. If you don't figure out what you're going to do when you win, when you win, you don't win.
You go first. I went. First.
The other thing that really, really tough about that Charlie Wilson's war is that this really was. The United States, I mean, I think it's fairly well established. Peter, you have more in-depth reading in the area than I do, but it's fairly well established that one of the main drivers, real motives for that was to embarrass the Russians with their own Vietnam in Afghanistan.
Now, Brzezinski boasted about this.
Yeah, yeah. And now you say, okay, guys, you know, you have a whole world to deal with, and you're telling me that the Russians, people didn't know that the communism was coming to an end, but I had been in Russia. There was all kinds of writing about it. Everyone knew that the Soviet Union would fall apart. The Russians have always been European-oriented. You're telling me that you're going to side with Mujahideen against the Russians just because they have the title communist right now? I mean, it's such a stupid, ineffective, decision, foreign policy decision. And it really was just to embarrass them because we'd just been embarrassed in Vietnam. It's like 2-year-olds on a playground, you know? It really, we don't need, we have all this power. We can be very effective in helping out. And I'm not saying the Americans have a burden that we need to help create a better world. We don't need to any more than anybody else. But we do have the capacity, and we do, many of us, have the ideals, and we have the technology. And, you know, I think we actually will be able to do it if we keep tamping down the other things over time and not expect to get rid of the way everybody else has been behaving for the last few thousand years, all in one decade or even in one century or even in two centuries. But I have a lot of confidence that these ideas are going to win because, you know, it is better for everybody not to go around destroying things but to get everybody to exercise their free will, create things. And, you know, do you want 5 billion people in the world starving to death, or would it be great if everybody – now, I know there's environmental issues about, you know, everybody else coming up to speed, but we can solve those being rich. We can't solve those being poor in the middle of a war across the world. So I don't think it's that problematic to bring, you know, clean water to everybody in the world. It's really just not that problematic.
I would like to pick up on another aspect of your question, the assumption that we're not likely to lose the next war. That's true if there are all of these what they call asymmetrical wars. But many people are frightened, not just me, that we're in a kind of 1914 situation, that America's power is gently declining the way Britain's did in the beginning of the 20th century. And new people are coming up to challenge, like China and so on. And that local wars, we've had two in the last 2 years that really terrified people that they could be the prelude to a major war. And the first one was Ukraine, and I think that one may be solved. But, you know, Putin, this terrible ogre in the American press, attacked all the time by Kerry and so on. By the way, I thought Kerry was a good man. I worked for Kerry once. I spent 6 months in Washington, worked for him. But it was Putin who defused the Ukrainian situation. He's always called the aggressor here. He's the real author of Minsk II, which is Syria now is a situation where we have American planes and Russian planes sharing the same airspace and really with quite radically different goals. One is to back up the government, which, by the way, in terms of UN charterees, the Russians are in better ground than we are there. And we are saying, well, no, we don't want Daesh, so we're going to back all these other people. And it turns out we give them arms and they sell the arms to Daesh. So we haven't done very well there. and I'm not making a prediction about it. I'm just saying that I think the way the long-term trends are going, we're moving into an area where the risk of not only of major warfare, but of major nuclear warfare is increasing and not decreasing. And that's why I come back to the importance of hanging on to what little tiny shreds we have of international agreement as the basis for strengthening those agreements.
And the time is coming to an end, but I'd like to say, you know, hang on to those tiny shreds. But in addition to that, I think what we need to hang on to is the reasons why we want to do this and our goals, as I've been saying. Because I think America's goals, stated goals, but I think America's goals are to create this culture. And I think that most of the European leaders, in spite of the fact that very few believe in it, they still would like to create it and see that would be a good thing. I think that the Russians at the top level are also on the same page. And plenty of people in China are, plenty of people in Japan are. We have the leaders of most of the developed countries that could agree to something that's fairly simple and not say you have to stop being communist or don't have to tell China that they don't have to be a one-party capitalist state. I mean, they're more in favor of capitalism than we are. They have one board of directors that runs a billion employees, you know, and they do it, you know, more efficiently than one could have imagined. And they just have this thin veneer of Marxist-Leninist thought that they almost never, go to either. And there's enough in common in all those countries and in other parts of the world for us to do this. The only question is, how intelligently are we going to go about doing it? Are we going to pout about different things that have happened? Are we going to behave like children, or are we going to behave like adults? And there are enough adults around to pull this off. There's always, you know, more other people than the adults. And you just have to say, is it really necessary to listen to them all the time? Is it really necessary? Sure. When we're angry and the anger is roused by politicians everywhere, we're going to make dumb decisions. But I think, this is why, you know, capitalism has helped, because it's created these big middle classes that where people really don't want to give up what they've got, and therefore they're harder to get roused in anger. And, you know, that's one of the great signs of positivity on the horizon. 300 million Chinese and 300 million Indians have just gotten into the middle class in the last couple of decades, and they're fears and their angers are all going to be diminished as a result of that, and they're going to be more in favor of the status quo. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to turn into, you know, Republicans or Democrats, but it does mean that we have a chance to try to have a little bit more stability and to talk about what we have in common. And it's really dumb to say that what we don't have in common is both political aims and religious aims, for example, and just say, well, let's just talk about the basics, the absolute basics of human life, and let's get there first. And everything else can be discussed later. Then we have a chance.
Are we winding up here?
That's it. You okay. Wind up.
Well, go ahead and wind up.
I'll try to make it very short. I want to make it very clear that I'm not a pacifist. Most of what I said is against war. I'm not a pacifist. Most of what I said is against Washington's recent policies. Don't think that I'm anti-American. Quite the opposite. I think America, as a country now, is the leader. It is still I've lived in many countries. This is the one I choose to live in. This is the one which still, no matter all the things I've been talking about, is still a model for the rest of the world. The American Revolution, which set up a constitution which limited government and put all people under that constitution, has been imitated all over the world. America is still a beacon. That some of us, I wanted to say in one of the questions that never got asked, but that we can have this discussion. Do you think I would dare go to Shanghai, to say Beijing or Moscow and criticize the government there? No, of course I wouldn't. This is the place. You are privileged, you're lucky, you're privileged, and you have the responsibility to see that America continues to play that kind of positive, constructive role, because I do think that there is a crisis in Washington now. I think America's gone off the rails, slowly, but incrementally, but increasingly, and especially since 9/11, where for the first time we are suspending parts of the Constitution and not making a secret of it. This is something which I think has to be reversed, and I think that meetings like this, they're happening all over the country, that I have hopes that it's not a waste of time to say that America should do better than it's doing right now.
Yeah, and I'll say one last thing on that. 9/11 was very scary. It was very fear-inspiring. But World War II was much, much worse on an almost daily, weekly basis, and we didn't change our policies. And I think people should remember that and say, we can handle this without changing those serious principles that we are trying to get other people to do in the world.
Exactly. Well, with that, we'd like to wrap up. Thank you, Dr. Peter Dale Scott and Mr. George Hammond, for your participation in this panel on the morality of warfare. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club of California in its 114th year of enlightened discussions. We are hereby adjourned.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you for doing this, George. That was a lot of fun.